Chapter 25. The Navy put an armed party aboard the Sea Hunter, but nothing could be done until an investigation team arrived. Austin needed no forensic expert to tell him the murderous sequence of events that had transpired aboard the unsuspecting ship. The attackers had arrived by sea, silently stolen onto the vessel, then made their way through the ship and systematically slaughtered everyone on her except for the one witness they purposely left alive. A maniac who talked of revenge had led the attack. The message left with the sole survivor made it clear that the raid was payback. Austin called NUMA headquarters and asked that a warning be issued to all the agency's vessels, especially those in the Mediterranean Sea. He felt responsible, despite Zavala's argument that no one could have anticipated the savage attack on the Sea Hunter. He could barely keep his anger under control. Zavala recognized the cold, distant expression on Austin's face, and he knew the contest between Austin and the killers had become intensely personal. If he hadn't seen what Boris and his minions had done on the NUMA ship, he might have felt sorry for them. The trip back to Istanbul on the Navy cruiser was uneventful. Austin and Zavala arrived at their Istanbul hotel in the wee hours of the morning. An overnight FedEx packet from the States awaited Austin at the front desk. He took it up to his room and smiled as he read the note inside the envelope. Herewith is enclosed information on the Odessa Star. We'll forward more as unearthed. Haven't you forgotten you owe me something? P. Austin called the hotel concierge and said a large tip would be forthcoming if he could dig up a recipe for Imam Baidi and forward it to Perlmutter. Then he scanned the material on the Odessa Star. The Lloyd's record was enlightening, but Austin didn't know what to make of the story of the Little Mermaid and filed it in the back of his mind. Perlmutter's description of the strange conversation with Dodson caught his attention. Curious. Why would the English lord hang up on Perlmutter? For an old derelict, the Odessa Star elicited strong reactions. At the mere mention of the vessel, Dodson had rung down a curtain of silence. Austin picked up the phone and called Zavala's room. "Cool your jets, my friend. I'm almost packed," Zavala said. "I'm happy to hear that. How would you like to take a slight detour through England? I need you to talk to someone. I'd do it myself, but Rudy and I have to get back to Washington to fill Sandecker in." Austin was also aware of his own impatience and sometimes intimidating physical presence, and reasoned that the soft-spoken Zavala might fare better with a reluctant source. "No problem. I may look up a lady friend in Chelsea. She'll be devastated when she learns you won't have time for socializing." "This won't wait," he said, his voice serious. "I'm bringing you something I'd like you to read." Austin went next door to Zavala's room. While Zavala dove into the material from Perlmutter, Austin called the concierge again and asked him to find a seat for Joe on the next flight to London. The concierge said he had finished faxing the recipe to Perlmutter and would do his best. Austin knew there were at least two ways of getting things done in Istanbul, the official route and the unofficial way that relied on a network of family and friends, and the leverage of IOUs for old favors. The concierge was apparently well-connected because he found the last seat on a plane leaving within 2 hours. Zavala finished reading the material. After conferring with Austin, he got on the phone and called Dodson. Identifying himself as a researcher for NUMA, he said he would be in London the following day and asked to talk to Dodson about his family's historical involvement in Britain's naval history and service to the Crown. It was a thinly veiled excuse that wouldn't get past a kindergarten teacher, but if Dodson suspected the subterfuge, he didn't let on. He said he would be available all day and gave directions to his house. As the British Airways jet began the final approach to Heathrow Airport, Zavala looked off toward London with longing in his soulful eyes. He wondered if the auburn-haired journalist he had dated still lived in Chelsea, and thought how nice it would be to catch up on old times over a tandoori at a favorite Indian restaurant on Oxford Street. With Herculean resolve, he pushed the thought from his mind. Prying an old family secret out of a reluctant British aristocrat would be hard enough without feminine distractions. Zavala breezed through customs, picked up his rental car, and headed for the Cotswolds, the historic Gloucestershire countryside a few hours' drive from London. He hoped none of the bean counters back at Numa would have a heart attack when they saw the bill for renting a Jaguar convertible. Zavala rationalized that the small luxury helped compensate for the dent Numa was putting in his love life. At this rate, he ruminated grimly, he'd be joining a monastery. Turning off the main highway, he drove briskly along meandering narrow roads, some no wider than cow paths, doing his best to stay to the left. The picturesque landscape looked like pictures from a calendar. The rolling hills and pastures were almost unnatural in their greenness. Sturdy houses of honey-brown stone clustered in the villages and dotted the unspoiled countryside. Lord Dodson lived in a tiny hamlet that looked like a village in one of those British mysteries, the ones in which everyone is suspected of the vicar's murder. Dodson's house stood off by itself on a winding lane slightly wider than the car. Zavala followed a gravel drive hemmed in by hedgerows and pulled up next to a vintage Morris Minor pickup truck. The truck was parked in front of a substantial two-story structure of warm brown stone and dark tile roof. The cottage was nothing like the manor Zavala had imagined an English lord would live in. A stone wall ringed the house, enclosing colorful flower gardens. A man dressed in patched cotton slacks and a faded work shirt was knee-deep in blossoms. Assuming he was speaking to the gardener, Zavala got out of the car and said, "Excuse me, I'm looking for Sir Nigel Dodson." A white stubble covered the man's chin. He removed his soiled cotton work gloves and extended his hand in a firm grip. "I'm Dodson," he said, to Zavala's surprise. "You must be the American gentleman who called yesterday." Zavala hoped Dodson didn't see his embarrassment. After hearing the upper-class accent on the phone, Zavala had pictured a craggy-chinned Englishman in tweeds with a bushy, upturned mustache decorating a stiff upper lip. Dodson was actually a small, slim, balding man. He was probably in his 70s, but he looked as fit as a man 20 years his junior. "Are those orchids?" Zavala asked. His family's adobe house in Santa Fe was surrounded by flower beds. "That's right. These are frog orchids. Spotted here, pyramidal there." Dodson raised an eyebrow in a hint that his own stereotype of Americans had been shattered. "I'm surprised you recognized them. They don't look like those big, meaty plants everybody thinks about when you mention orchids." "My father was crazy about flowers. Some of those blossoms looked familiar." "Well, I'll have to show you around after we're done. Now, you must be thirsty after your trip, Mr. Zavala. You said you were in Istanbul? Haven't been there in years. Fascinating city." He invited Zavala to follow him around behind the house to an expansive flagstone patio. Dodson called in through the open French doors to his housekeeper, a stout, ruddy-faced woman named Jenna. She eyed Zavala as if he were an insect her employer had picked off one of his orchids and brought them tall glasses of iced tea. They sat under an oriental pergola laced with ivy. The broad lawn, as well manicured as a golf course, sloped down to a slow-flowing river and extensive marshes. A boat was tied up at a small dock. Dodson sipped his tea and gazed out at the vista. Paradise. Sheer paradise. His piercing blue eyes turned to his guest. "Well, Mr. Zavala, has this something to do with the telephone call I received a few days ago from Mr. Perlmutter?" "Indirectly." "I've made some inquiries. It seems Mr. Perlmutter is highly respected in marine history circles. How may I help you? Perlmutter was doing some research for Numa when he came across a reference to your grandfather. He was puzzled about why you were reluctant to talk about Lord Dodson's papers. And so am I. I'm afraid I was abrupt with Mr. Perlmutter. Please offer him my apology if you see him. His query caught me off guard. He paused and let his eyes sweep over the roof of his cottage. Do you have any idea how old this house is? Zavala studied the weathered stones and massive chimneys. I'll take a stab at it, he said with a smile. Old? I see you're a man of caution. I like that. Yes, it is very old. This village dates back to the Iron Age. The original Dodson Manor, beyond those trees where you can't see it, goes back to the 17th century. I have no children to pass the property along to and couldn't afford to maintain the old ark in any case, so I turned it over to the National Trust and retained this cottage. It rests on a foundation placed here at the time of Augustus Caesar. I could show you the Roman numerals carved in the cellar stones. The house itself is one of four that have occupied the site for over 2,000 years. The present structure dates back to the 1400s, just about the time your country was being discovered. I'm not sure I understand what this has to do with my question. Dodson leaned forward like an Oxford don instructing a dim student. This country doesn't think in terms of decades or even centuries, as in America, but in millennia. 80 years is a mere tick of the clock. There are powerful families who could still be embarrassed by the revelations in my grandfather's papers. Zavala nodded. I respect your wishes and won't press you, but is there anything you can tell me? Dodson's eyes twinkled with merriment. I'm prepared to tell you everything you want to know, young man. Pardon? Zavala had hoped to excavate a few nuggets and hadn't expected Dodson to offer him the whole gold mine. After Mr. Perlmutter called, I gave this matter a great deal of thought. In my grandfather's will, he left his papers to Guildhall, to be made available to the public at the end of the century. Even I had never seen them. They were in my father's possession and became my responsibility after his death. They were being held by the law firm that handled my grandfather's will, and I didn't get around to actually reading them until they were at the library. I pulled them back after I came across my grandfather's narrative explaining his part in all this. Now, however, I've decided to honor his wishes, despite the consequences. Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. Admiral Farragut at the Battle of Mobile Bay. You're something of a naval historian yourself. It's hard not to be in my business. Which brings up a question of my own. Exactly what is Numa's interest in this matter? One of our survey ships found the wreck of an old freighter named the Odessa Star in the Black Sea. Dodson sat back in his chair and shook his head. The Odessa Star. So that's what happened to her. Father thought she was caught in one of the dreadful storms that can plague those bloody waters. Not exactly. She was sunk by gunfire. Dodson couldn't have looked more startled if Zavala had thrown the glass of iced tea in his face. He composed himself. Excuse me. I'll give you some material to read. He disappeared into the house and came back with what looked like a thick manuscript. I'm going into the village to pick up some heirloom plantings for my garden. You should have plenty of time to absorb this. We can talk about it on my return. Jenna will keep you well supplied with tea or something stronger if you wish. Just ring this little bell. Zavala watched Dodson's battered truck jounce down the driveway. He was surprised Dodson had entrusted the manuscript to a complete stranger. On second thought, Jenna looked capable of restraining him if he made one step toward his rental car with packet in hand. He untied the thick black ribbon that bound the pages of lined, pale yellow paper and riffled through the manuscript. The letters were gracefully executed by someone who had studied penmanship, but the strokes were thick and wild, slanting forward, as if the writer was in a great hurry. Attached was evidently an English translation of the transcript. The first page contained a short paragraph. "This is the journal of Major Peter Yakovlev, captain in the Tsar's Royal Cossacks Guard. I swear to God on my oath as an officer that all I'm about to tell you is true." Zavala turned a page. "Odessa, 1918. As I sit in my humble room writing with fingers crippled by frostbite, I think of all I have endured in the past weeks. Bolshevik treachery, unspeakable cold and starvation have killed most of my Santia, the band of loyal Cossacks, originally 100 strong. Only a handful of brave men remain. But the history of this valiant band will be written in blood, as saviors of Mother Russia, guardians of the flame of Peter the Great. Our own privations are nothing compared to those suffered by the gracious lady and her four daughters, who, by the grace of God, have come into our care. God save the Tsar. Within hours we leave our country forever and will set sail across the sea to Constantinople. This is the end of one story and the beginning of another." Zavala became totally engrossed in the pages. The captain tended toward rhetorical flourishes, but he told a compelling story that took Zavala away from the sunlight playing on the English countryside to the bleak Russian winter. Blizzards howled across the steppes, death lurked in the dark forest, and treachery lay in wait in the humblest shack. He almost shivered with the cold as he read of the hardships the captain and his men endured as they traveled through a dangerous and unforgiving land toward the sea. A shadow fell across the pages. Zavala looked up and saw Dodson standing there, a bemused smile on his face. "Fascinating, isn't it?" Zavala rubbed his eyes, then checked his watch. 2 hours had passed. "It's incredible. What does it all mean?" The Englishman picked up the bell and rang it. "Tea time." The housekeeper brought out a steaming teapot and a tray of cucumber sandwiches and scones. Dodson poured their cups full, then leaned back in his chair and tented his fingers. "My grandfather was undersecretary in King George's Foreign Office in 1917. He and the king had been drinking and womanizing companions in their youth. He was well acquainted with all the royal heads of Europe, including Tsar Nicholas, who was George's cousin." Nicholas was a short, slight man, although his ancestors had been a race of giants, and his limitations went beyond the physical. My father used to say that Nick wasn't a bad sort, but a bit of a dim bulb. That description could fit half the political leaders in the world today. No argument there. Nicholas was even more inept than most, totally unsuited by intelligence and temperament for the job. Yet he had absolute authority over 130 million people. He was entitled to the revenue from 1 million square miles of crown lands and gold mines. Technically speaking, he was the richest man in the world. He owned 8 magnificent palaces and was worth an estimated $8 to $10 billion. In addition, he was the head of the church, and in the eyes of the peasantry, one step removed from God. That would have been a crushing responsibility for anyone. Quite so. He couldn't govern worth a damn, hated being Tsar, except for the chance to play soldier, and would have preferred living out his days in an English country house like this one. Unfortunately, it wasn't to be. The Russian Revolution came along.
Precisely.
You probably know much of what I'm about to say, but let me pull it all together for you. The conservatives in his court wanted him out even before the revolution. They worried that Russia's battering in World War I would trigger an uprising, and they hated the mad monk Rasputin because he had his hooks into the Tsarina. There were demonstrations, food shortages, rampant inflation, strikes, refugees, and anger over the millions of young Russians killed in this senseless war. Like the autocrat he was, Nicholas overreacted to the protests. His troops turned against him, and he abdicated after being told it was in the best interests of the country. The provisional government arrested him, and he and his family were kept prisoner in their palace outside St. Petersburg. The provisional government was overthrown by the well-organized Bolsheviks under Lenin, and Russia began its long, tragic experiment with Marxism. So Lenin and the communists inherited the Tsar and his family. That's a good way of putting it. Lenin had the royal family and some servants and retainers moved to a mansion in Ekaterinburg, a gold mining center in the Urals. And there, in July of 1918, they were supposedly all shot and bayoneted. Lenin was under pressure from his hardliners, who wanted the entire family eliminated, and his people were talking to the Germans, who insisted on the safety of the women, but regarded the death of the Tsar as an internal Russian affair. Lenin ordered the limited killings, then shifted the blame from his people to leftist revolutionaries. The story was generally accepted. What was your father's role at the time?
The king had ordered him to keep a close watch on events. King George and the Tsar were cousins, after all. My father dispatched a trusted Russian-speaking agent named Albert Grimley to determine what had happened. You might say Grimley was the James Bond of his day. He arrived at Ekaterinburg shortly after the White Army chased the communists out and talked to the army officer investigating the murders. He found bullet holes and blood, but no bodies. The officer confided to Grimley that at most only two of the Romanovs had been murdered, the Tsar and his son, who was heir to the throne. The officer's superiors suppressed his findings. Why would they do that? The Whites were commanded by a reactionary monarchist general on a divine mission to save Russia from ruin. He wanted the public to believe that the Bolsheviks murdered women and children. The family were more valuable to his cause as martyrs than as living people.
What happened to the women?
It's all in Grimley's report. He suggested that the Bolsheviks move the Tsarina and the four girls before the male Romanovs were disposed of. The communists were in military trouble, and Lenin may have wanted the family as bargaining chips in case he got himself into a hash. Some researchers think the Tsarina and her daughters were taken to a city called Perm and stayed there until Perm came under attack by the Whites. Witnesses say the family was moved out with treasure and gold bullion that the communists had accumulated, and they and their treasure supposedly vanished from the official record on a train trip to Moscow. The Soviets clamped the lid down on all further information. It would have tarnished Lenin's halo if it got out that he was dealing with the Germans over the fate of the Romanovs.
What happened to the Romanov treasure?
Only a small fraction of it was ever found.
Your father reported his agent's findings to the king.
He filed a report saying that the mother and girls were probably alive and asked for help in putting together a rescue scheme. King George washed his hands of the affair, although he and Nicholas were related. Remember that the hated Kaiser was cousin to George and Nicholas as well. Family loyalty only went so far among the royals. The king was afraid that he'd stir up the British left if he gave the women asylum. The Tsarina was German by birth, and Germany was the enemy. So, no attempt was made to rescue them. A rescue scheme was hatched by some Englishmen, but it didn't go anywhere because the family was moved. There were a couple of attempts by Cossacks, supported by Germans who wanted a restoration of Russia's imperial house. The Kaiser may have felt guilty about inflicting Lenin on the Tsar to take pressure off the Eastern Front. The most interesting plot was a scheme to kidnap the family and spirit them through German-occupied Ukraine, then across the Black Sea in a neutral ship. Why did it fail? It didn't, actually. They were rescued? Yes, but not by the Germans. The Cossacks didn't trust Germany. Somewhere along the way, possibly during that trek to Moscow, the intrepid band of Cossacks who had failed to save them once before managed to kidnap the family and fought their way to the Black Sea. Zavala picked up the manuscript. Major Yakovlev? Dodson smiled. The Cossack officer must have been extremely resourceful and determined. Yakovlev is vague about exactly how the women came under his protection. He was saving that for when he got out of Russia. The journal was to be published when the Romanovs made their appearance in Europe. This manuscript was to go to Europe by a neutral ship and would garner them the instant sympathy of the world. It came into the possession of my grandfather, and when the family failed to arrive, he kept it for want of anything better to do. Do you have any idea who might have sunk the ship? This is where it gets dicey, Dodson said with a frown. Especially in light of what you said about the ship having been sunk by gunfire. He took a deep breath. As my father recounts it in his papers, the family were to be taken secretly to Turkey, where a German U-boat would be waiting to spirit them out of the country. Turkey was allied with Germany. Britain was told of the plan and agreed not to attack the U-boat on its way to Europe. That was generous of the British. Dodson guffawed. Oh, they were a wily bunch in the good old days. Their generosity was based on the assumption that the family would be captured by the Bolsheviks. That was quite a gamble. Not really. England told Lenin and his thugs that the family were escaping in the Odessa Star. Your grandfather knew of this? He argued strenuously against it, but was overruled. By whom? By King George. Zavala's eyes narrowed. I see why you were reluctant to make this information public. Some people might not like learning that the king was a traitorous informant and accessory to a multiple murder. I don't know if I'd go so far as to identify the king as a criminal, though what he did was morally reprehensible. It was naivete on his part, but George never dreamed that Lenin would be so ruthless as to order them assassinated. My father said the king assumed the women would be kept in a convent. The Bolsheviks may have given the impression that no harm would come to them. They sat in silence for a few moments, alone with their thoughts, listening to the trill of the birds. Zavala shook his head in puzzlement. There's something I don't get. A few years ago, the Russians dug up some bones that were supposedly identified as those of the Romanov family. The Soviet government was masterful at fabricating evidence. I would assume that they passed along that skill to their successors. There may be some truth to the story of the Tsar's bones, but even so, the remains of the boy, Alexis, and his sister, the Grand Duchess Maria, were never found. Maria? Yes. She was the second youngest. Why? Zavala went out to his car and returned with the Perlmutter file.
He leafed through the contents and pulled out the book excerpt on the Little Mermaid, which he handed to Dodson. The Englishman donned a pair of wire-rimmed reading glasses. As he pored over the file, his expression grew grave.
Astounding! If this is accurate, the Romanov line didn't die out. Maria, or Marie, as she's called here, went on to marry and have children.
That's my take on it.
Do you know what this means? Somewhere there may be a legitimate heir to the Tsar's throne.
He ran his fingers through his hair.
My God, what a catastrophe!
I'm not sure I understand. Dodson composed himself. Russia is in the midst of great turmoil. It is still seeking its identity. Beneath this bubbling cauldron is a fire of nationalism. Those who would go back to the days of Peter the Great and the Tsars have touched a yearning in the Russian people, but all they have had to sell is a memory of a forgotten time. With an actual heir to the Tsar, their cause would have focus. It is a country that still controls weapons of mass destruction and a major share of the world's natural resources. It will not be safe for the world if Russia lapses into a civil war and follows the lead of the worst kind of demagogue. British complicity in the plot against the Tsar will stir up all those paranoid feelings against the West. He affixed Zavala with a steely gaze. Tell your superiors that they must be discreet. Otherwise, no one may be able to control the consequences. Zavala was bowled over by the emotional reaction from this reserved Englishman. Yes, of course. I'll tell them what you said. But Dodson seemed to have forgotten that Zavala was even there. The Tsar is dead, he murmured. Long live the Tsar.